And the best example I've come up with is comparing them to medicine. All right, I want to compare a herbicide to medicine. So stick with me for a minute as we kind of unpack this a little bit.
Welcome to Working in the Weeds, the podcast by the UF IFAS Center for Aquatic and Invasive Plants. I'm your co-host, Christine Krebs, the communications manager out here. And as per usual, I am accompanied by co-host Dr. Jason Farrell.
Hey, Christine.
Hello. Today, we're going to have a conversation that we've been thinking about having for a while. Do you want to tell our listeners what we're going to start talking about?
Yeah, we've been really wanting to get into a conversation about herbicides in particular, what they do and how they work. But we've not really known how to start this conversation because this is something I've studied for over 25 years, and it's hard to know how to put all of that in an episode or two. You know, kind of where do you start? How do you get going with this huge topic? But with that, there's also a controversial subject, and we want to handle it in the right way. So what we're thinking about doing is sort of starting a multi-part series focusing on herbicides, how they work, why we use them. And this is just going to sort of be the launch of this conversation.
Yeah, there's a lot of experts that are researching aquatic herbicides, particularly here at the Center for Aquatic and Invasive Plants. And they play a major role when it comes to aquatic plant management. And so with that, I think this episode's going to be more of an overview on what are aquatic herbicides and why do we use them?
And probably some review as well.
Yeah, because remember, y'all, we've had some episodes on the pesticide registration process, safety, and even some hints of like the history of it when you think about the Rachel Carson Silent Spring episode. But this one's going to be an overview and review. So as we get started, let's just kind of briefly talk about why we need to even manage plants, right? What is the role of aquatic plant management?
Well, again, we've had this conversation before, but I think it's important to start here, right? Because there's a lot of folks that think there's no reason to use herbicides at all. But we have to remember that they serve a real purpose. And that purpose is to ensure biodiversity. So biodiversity means you have lots of different types of plants in the same area at the same time, because different animals, different insects need different things. So when there is a real diverse environment, everything has what they need when they need it. The problem you run into is these invasive plants will move in and they start to dominate. And these really specific plants that are supporting real specific animals or insects often can't compete. So as they start to disappear, now the animals begin to become less numerous, the insects become less numerous, and everything just changes because we have that one invader that's coming in and causing problems. And so often that one invader was brought in by us. Right? It is an escaped forage plant. It's an escaped ornamental. It's an escaped aquarium plant. So we brought it in. We caused the problem. And at some level, I believe that we owe it to the environment to try to help manage this plant to bring back what we have taken away.
Yeah, I think there are groups of people who have this sort of belief that let's let nature be nature. But I think in this day and age, with how much the world has grown in population and how much humans alter the environment, I think people don't understand that they really need managed nature, right? We need to be a part of the story instead of acting like we're not impacting it. And so aquatic plant management's goal is to then restore this biodiversity in the environment because of these invasive plants that impact the richness of that area.
Right. So, and I think, you know, using that word restore is important. When John Lane was our guest, he said over and again, restore the balance. And that's what we're trying to do with these management practices is bring things back into balance.
Yeah. And so aquatic plant management isn't just herbicides, right? We talk about this integrated approach. We have discussed management many times. And of course, there's mechanical harvesting, then physical methods like drawdowns, biocontrol agents. So there's a lot of options. But with all of those options, why do we commonly rely on herbicides to manage plants?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is one we don't talk about a lot. And this is really a philosophical discussion. And I'm going to give you my position on why I think herbicides fit in a modern world. So just to define some terms real quick, A pesticide is any chemical that is used to manage a pest. It doesn't matter if it's a weed, a fungus, or an insect. But a herbicide is very specific. It's a type of pesticide that we use to control plants. So all of those management techniques you just mentioned, from drawdowns to hand removal to mechanical control, they all fit. They have a purpose, and they all are needed to be part of this integrated strategy.
And we use them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like, it's not something we've done years ago and we've left. It's something that's used in tandem with herbicides, right?
Exactly. And the issue, though, is every one of these methods have very clear strengths and very clear weaknesses. And we have to keep our heads straight that none of these options are a silver bullet that work all the time. Now, some people would say that's untrue because herbicides are used all the time in exclusion of these others, so they have become your silver bullet. Well, herbicides are used a lot because for a couple of different reasons. Number one, by and large, they are going to be very reliable. Biocontrol is an amazing technology, and we need to continue to invest heavily in that science to make sure we have these insect agents that are in there doing what we need to do. Sometimes biocontrols aren't there, or they're just not there in sufficient numbers to keep up with how fast the plants are growing. Mechanical control, it's a great way of removing plants and all those nutrients from the watershed and getting it out of there and solving that problem. But if you're in an area that's got a lot of stumps, if you're in an area that has shallow water, mechanical is just not going to be an option. But herbicides are a very reliable and fast way to go in and remedy a situation to help it right now keep from getting worse. All right, so that's one thing, is that it is very reliable. The second reason herbicides are used a lot is pound for pound, they're one of the cheapest things you can do. So biocontrol is sustainable, but it can cost millions and millions and millions to ever get that first hit.
And if you all remember, years to even find the insect that is specific enough to do the job.
Yes. Mechanical, again, there are a lot of people. There's a lot of maintenance. There are just moving these big machines down the road. Getting them into the lake may mean that you're using a crane to actually get them in the lake. So there can be high expense on some of these great tools. But for chemical control, you need a boat and you need an applicator. So it is low levels of equipment, and that individual can go in there very inexpensively and very reliably and get a population of plants under control quickly before more damage is done. Now, that said, herbicides are not perfect, right? They are not handling the nutrient management issues, right? So they are going to, as soon as those plants die, they're going to release nutrients, and you can have algae blooms, you can have other issues. The other thing is, a herbicide is not a permanent solution. They don't go out and persist in the environment for years and years and give you long-term control. They are quick, and they stop the problem and provide a right-now solution. So herbicides aren't perfect either. That's why they're not a silver bullet, but they're very reliable, and pound for pound, they're very inexpensive. So we utilize them pretty heavily because we know what we can expect for that dollar.
And so you just said that herbicides aren't perfect. And many of our listeners know there's a rich history behind herbicides in aquatic plant management. So while that is true, they've come a long way, though, right? The herbicides used in the 1800s, the things that they tried in the Green Menace episode, for example, are not the same things that we use today, right? So can you talk a little bit about how this technology has advanced and what the science kind of looks like with this?
Yeah, as a culture progresses, you have more and more infrastructure that has been built that you need to maintain. 500 years ago, there wasn't a whole lot of need for industrial, quote-unquote, weed control along roadsides because there weren't really good roads. There weren't railroads. We didn't have flood control canals in most places. So the amount of management you needed was really low. But starting at the turn of the 1900s, we now have railroads crisscrossing the country. We're digging drainage canals. We're building infrastructure, and you've got to maintain it. And they realized early on that weed control was a big part of maintaining that investment. So it was about that time where railroads started saying, we have got to be able to keep trees from growing up into the railroad tracks. So we've got to figure out how to do weed control. Well, how do you do it? Well, they didn't have anything. So what they would do is they would use salt. They would go out with hundreds of tons per acre and just dump salt along these railroad corridors. And it was reasonably effective for a short time. But my gracious, think about hundreds of tons per acre and then mile after mile after mile of railroad. It was very difficult.
And we as humans use salt for a lot of different things. So it's like, dang, we're going to use this resource for this problem and then cause a shortage, for example, in the food supply or something.
But you see that we're trying to address a solution with poor technology. We see this again with the Green Menace story. If you're not familiar with it, go back and listen to that in a previous season. But this was when water hyacinth was first introduced to the St. John's River. It's stopping navigation, it's stopping transport, it's causing flooding. What do we do? Well, you've got to get in there and manage those plants. Well, we didn't have anything. So they were using boiling water. Can we scald the plants to death? Not very effectively. They would put fuel oil on them and try to set them on fire. Well, that didn't work either. Finally, they found a product that was quite effective. Unfortunately, it turned out to be arsenic and lead, which was extremely toxic. Applicators died. Cows that were feeding along the river died. Terrible solution, right? But still, you see that there is a need in a civilized, industrialized society for weed control. It just took us a while to get there.
And they even had, I mean, there's historical images of people on the bridges across the St. John's pulling these plants out of the water. So it was like, who knows if that was really making a dent in the situation, but there were even physical attempts to kind of solve this problem.
Right. And as we are moving down this road and trying to find solutions, there was no need for oversight yet because we didn't really know what the problems were yet. Oh, okay, somebody died. We've got to stop that. But who? Who has jurisdiction? How do we determine who can do what and what they can use? None of that infrastructure was in place back then. It was simply chemists looking for molecules that would solve a problem. The chemist wasn't working with the biologist yet. The biologist wasn't working with the toxicologist. And the toxicologist wasn't working with the legislature to try to put a governmental overview in place so that we can actually solve the problem and not create other environmental disasters. We had to grow into this position.
And I mean, that's science as a whole, right? We know better now is what science is about. And a lot of research, especially nowadays, the emphasis is to be interdisciplinary, to work together and ask the bigger questions with multiple experts kind of working on the solution. And so that's kind of the story of herbicide technology progressing, right?
Absolutely. So as the story continues to go, we find ourselves in the 50s. And that is when Rachel Carson started to step forward and say, wait a minute, we need to take a time out here. And she wrote her pivotal book in the early 1960s, Silent Spring. And again, we reviewed that book in a previous episode, and I would recommend going back and listening to it because seeing the impact that she had and the question she was asking was just phenomenal and decades ahead of its time. But what she was able to do was bring the biologist and the chemist and the toxicologist and the government all together in the same place at the same time and say, we have got to have a structure in place that is looking at these chemicals that we're putting into the environment. That movement directly led to the formation of the EPA in 1970-ish. But with that was the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, and the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. A lot happened in that 1970 to 1973 range. And now we have the EPA really looking at what happens and how do we know when or if to put these new chemicals into the environment.
And as science progresses with all of these different topics, the rules and regulations then evolve in response to that. So things are continuously getting better and adapting to the information that we find out with these different products, for example.
Yes. And a lot of folks will make statements like, we don't know what happens when this herbicide goes into the water. Well, we know a lot because the EPA requires a lot. So I want to just kind of take a minute and sort of briefly walk through what does the EPA do now when a new herbicide is proposed. Okay. So the first thing they're going to do is they look at that molecule and they just figure out the chemistry. You know, what is the boiling point? What is the melting point? And try to understand from a chemical perspective. Soon thereafter, they look at toxicity. All right. What is this thing going to do? Is it toxic at low levels or high levels? What does it do to mammals, such as people, cows? What does it do to fish? What does it do to invertebrates like snails and little other things? All of this stuff starts being looked at and they try to understand the toxicity. From that, they go, okay, if somebody's going to apply this, what type of protection do they need? That's why some products, you'll see the applicator wearing gloves and glasses. Other products, you see them wearing gloves, glasses, and coveralls. That is all informed by the type of work that the EPA does in order to protect that applicator. But then it goes even past that. Okay, after the application has been made, how long until somebody can enter that area? Let's say an application has been made to a lake. How long does someone have to wait before they can swim or fish or go out and use that water maybe as a potable drinking water source? So all of these things are looked at because we're looking at the exposure and the toxicity and what type of chemical it is. So all of this is being factored in, but it doesn't stop there. Okay, we've made an application to a lake. What happens if a duck flies in and lands in that water? What is the risk to the duck? So it's not just people, but it's also, what about the duck? What about the other things that weren't there when we applied that might come in? We have to protect them as well. Then it goes a step further. Well, what happens if the application is on a windy day and there's drift and the herbicide moves out of the lake and onto land and onto a tree and there's a squirrel in the tree? Well, what happens to the squirrel? That is factored in. And if they find that there is tremendous risk to that squirrel, it might even be that that herbicide is not allowed to be used around trees at all. So these secondary effects, we call them non-targets because we're not trying to manage squirrels. So what happens to that non-target species that may interact with this herbicide unwillingly? We have to know that. And then again, toward the end here is what happens to the molecule after it's in the water? Okay, let's say that the fish are not directly impacted, or the invertebrates, the snails, are not directly impacted. But what if that molecule stays around for a year, 2 years? How long does it stay? Or does it stay for a week? We have to know how long does it persist in the environment and how does it break down in the environment, because a molecule that stays around too long is a problem. Again, we want a pesticide to come in, address the issue at hand, and then dissipate. We can't have it persist for weeks and weeks and months. That's a problem. That's an environmental issue, and we can't have that.
And so how long does this process take, this sort of registration process where they're looking into this product?
Well, with all of the steps and all of the work they have to do, it is 7 to 10 years, depending on how the data come back, because sometimes you turn in data and EPA looks at it and goes, we got a problem here. You've got to collect more data. So it can be 7 to 10 years. and it now costs between $300 and $400 million. So we're talking about a tremendous expenditure and up to a decade before we know, is this product something that we can put into the atmosphere, put into the environment without concern of
unreasonable
effects.
And that's the sort of progression of the research behind it and the registration and allowing the product to even be on the shelves or an option as a tool for aquatic plant management. When we think about using aquatic herbicides in management, how much of it do we even use? Because I remember when we were talking in Green Menace, they were kind of dumping or spraying arsenic, right, into the environment sort of with these large amounts, right? And so are we still kind of using that much when we're doing management?
Yeah. So when you look at what the EPA requires, over the years, their standards have just increased and increased and increased. And what it takes for a new herbicide to be registered is way more stringent than it was years ago. So when you look at old chemistry, you know, pounds per acre was very common. The materials we're using now, we're talking ounces and sometimes a fraction of an ounce per acre. All right. Well, then what does that mean in the water? So, because in water, you usually treat the entire water column. So it's sort of by volume, not by area. Well, so we'll measure that in parts per billion. All right. So a lot of our herbicides are now applied at a part per billion range. Somewhere between 5 and 30 part per billion is quite common. Okay, so then what is a part per billion?
Yeah, I mean, I half the time don't really know what an acre looks like, right? So,
well, exactly. And a billion is so big, it's hard to wrap your mind around it. It just becomes a big number.
But you did come into the office the other day with this amazing sort of metaphor example. So let's give it a shot on here.
Okay, so a part per billion would be something like 1 gram in 260,000 gallons of water.
And so what's a gram?
So a gram, if you think about going to a restaurant and you see the little Splenda packets on the table that are, you know, you put in your tea, one Splenda packet is about 1 gram. Okay, so we're talking one Splenda packet in 260 some odd gallons of water. Well, my gracious, how much is 260 gallons of water?
A lot.
A lot. So a normal backyard swimming pool is 15 to 20,000 gallons. Okay.
Wow.
So one part per billion would be like taking one Splenda packet and dividing it up in between 10 to 15 backyard pools. And that means every one of those pools would have one part per billion of Splenda.
Wow.
So we're talking tiny, tiny amounts. We're not talking about going out with pounds and pounds and pounds for most herbicides. It can seem that way, but when you got to think of it in part per billion, and at the end of the day, we're talking about Splenda packets being divvied up into entire swimming pools. That's the goal. That's the concentration we're trying to reach.
And so when you see an applicator on the water with an airboat and there's a giant tank on the boat and they're spraying with what seems like a firefighter amount of hose gun pressure, that is a solution with a specific concentration of herbicide mixed in with a lot of water to then apply it on that plant.
That's exactly okay. Right. So you've got to getting down to these low concentrations is really hard, and you've got to use a lot of dilution. When we work in the lab and we're trying to do experiments, we cannot purchase instruments that are sensitive enough to give us one part per billion. What we have to do is make like a gallon of a solution and then pull like little tiny amounts out of that and dilute that. And that is the same thing that the applicators are doing in the field. So they start with their concentrated herbicide, they dilute it, then they apply it.
Okay. So with the registration process and the research that's been happening and using these smaller concentrations in management, there's this sort of new era of herbicides, and the technology has progressed significantly. when the smaller concentrations are used, does that mean that the technology is more toxic and more effective or more powerful than the older chemistries where we had to use more because it was just salt or just arsenic at the time? Or is it completely different?
Yeah. And I hear that sometimes, like, oh man, this, there's such a small amount that's needed. This is such a powerful, destructive herbicide, and we've got to be so careful with it. Well, possibly. We always need to respect these pesticides. We need to handle them appropriately. But because they have tiny, tiny use requirements, doesn't mean that they are off the scale more toxic or more dangerous. What it means is that they have been specifically designed to target really particular mechanisms within that plant. And we're trying to shut down a mechanism in that plant that will result in the plant dying. Well, when you really target it to that process, sometimes tiny amounts, sometimes plants are just really sensitive to turning off that process. So it's not that we're putting these terribly toxic poisons that are broad-scale environmental toxins into the environment. We are using materials that are extremely precise, targeting one specific process in the plant and just turning that process off.
And so these specific mechanisms that these herbicides are designed for, or how they work in the plants, we'll talk about that in a future episode, because that is a lot of chemistry that we will get into.
Yep, that's a lot
later
to unpack.
On. Yeah. But let's just do an overview of what happens once these herbicides are applied, after they're sprayed, so to speak. We all remember that DDT lasted a very long time and caused all sorts of negative issues. But also remember that DDT was the start and the reason why Rachel Carson even wrote the book years ago to begin with, right? So we don't even use DDT anymore. So what happens when the sort of modern era herbicides are used in the environment?
Exactly. So DDT was an insecticide, and it was very effective. It wasn't highly toxic to humans, but the problem is it lasted forever, and it would just build up year after year after year in the environment, and that's what we cannot have. And to your point, that is exactly why Rachel Carson was really pushing for the formation of EPA, and DDT was the first molecule, the number one first molecule that the EPA removed from the market. They said, this thing just has no place being in the environment. So if you recall just a moment ago when we were talking about all of these different tests that the EPA does, 7 to 10 years, $300 to $400 million, we ended with environmental fate and really understanding what do these things do in the environment? How do they persist? Why do they persist? And then what happens to them? So DDT lasted forever. We cannot and will not tolerate that. So we have to understand if there is a herbicide going into the environment, what happens to it. And what happens is that it must break down.
And when an herbicide or any sort of chemical breaks down in the environment, it doesn't break down into the smaller versions of what it already is. Chemically, it breaks down into very basic building blocks like carbon and oxygen, right?
Exactly. So you think about these molecules, most of them are just carbon with some other things tied to them. And as that molecule starts to break apart, usually, as soon as that molecule is changed, even in a slight way, it loses its pesticidal activity. So the first thing that happens is that, boom, it's no longer a pesticide. It's no longer active against plants. And then it just continues to break down into smaller, more basic pieces until you end up with something like carbon dioxide or carbon and oxygen.
So what are some common ways that aquatic herbicides break down in the environment?
So there's about three ways. One of the first ways and very common ways they break down is through microbes. So all over the environment, all the time, you have bacteria and you have fungi that are out there eating organic things, okay? So if you've ever carved a pumpkin around Thanksgiving, right? So I'm from the Midwest, and we would carve a pumpkin sometime in early to mid-October. You sit it on the porch, and we've got cool days and cool nights, and it's almost like the carved pumpkin is sitting in a refrigerator, right? It's nice and cool, and it would sit there and look nice for weeks, and finally you throw it away. Well, I moved to Florida and you carve a pumpkin. And then 2 days later, it was leaking and like sagging and collapsing. And it had this black and gray stuff growing on the outside. That was fungal pathogens. All right. A fungus had gotten in there and was very quickly, because of the warm weather, was eating that pumpkin. Fungus and bacteria eat anything that has a carbon structure, whether it's a pumpkin, whether it's leaves that you've swept up in your yard, or whether it's a herbicide. So herbicides are no different. So they have a carbon structure, and as they're in the environment, these microbes just start chewing them up until there's nothing left, okay? To the point that there is a very commonly applied aquatic herbicide called endothol, sold as Aquathol. It is microbially degraded in the environment to the point that it's not common practice to apply it in the summer.
Oh.
So we want it to go out in cold water, like the water is in a refrigerator, so that microbial activity is suppressed. We want to apply it during cold water scenarios, because if you apply it during the summer, the microbes chew it up so fast, it's not there long enough to give you weed control. So this is happening all the time in the environment.
Mm. So microbial breakdown is one of the three. What's the next one?
The next is photolytic or light breakdown, okay? We've all heard the saying that sunlight is the greatest disinfectant, right? Sunlight breaks down almost anything. So have you ever noticed an old car, maybe one that's 20 or 30 years old?
Usually red.
Well, and what color is it now?
Like a pink.
They go from red to pink. Well, why is that? It's because the sunlight has actually broken down those paint molecules until they're not red anymore. And all that's left is just sort of a shell of what they used to be. The same thing happens if you have things on a bulletin board by a window in your office or a poster by a window. You'll notice with time, it just fades, the colors start to change. Why? Because the sunlight is breaking down that ink and it's not the same color, if you can even see the color anymore. The same thing happens with herbicides. As the light shines into the water, those UV rays, those powerful rays, the same ones that burn your skin, they will attack those herbicide molecules and break them down. And as the light is breaking them down, the microbes are chewing on them as well. So these processes are working together. But sunlight is a primary way that a lot of our herbicides in the environment actually break down and become simple, just pieces of what they used to be.
So microbial and photolytic, the microbes in sort of the environment, like funguses, and then photolytic, so the sunlight. What's the third way?
The third way is a process called hydrolysis. And this one is a bit harder to envision. But think about your stomach. Okay, so in your stomach, you have acid that your stomach is producing, and you have water. Why do you have acid in your stomach? Well, because that low pH and that water start working together, and they start attacking all of the molecules that are coming in for digestion. And that big piece of potato that you've eaten gets broken down very quickly into other pieces that your body can absorb. That piece of pork chop gets broken down because the acid and the water are working together. The same thing happens in the atmosphere and in a lake. You have low pH conditions because you have acids from decaying pine needles coming in, or you have high pH scenarios from hydrilla sucking all of the carbon out of the water. These big differences in pH with the water attack those molecules and break them down. So that is a third way, and that's just a physical chemistry phenomenon. So one is microbes, living things, eating up your herbicide. The second is the sunlight physically destroying them. And third is the water just chemically interacting with that molecule and breaking it down. And all of these things are happening all the time.
And, you know, you think about it, water is hydrogen and oxygen. And so those things are going to react to whatever the herbicide compound is. And so it kind of makes sense. Chemistry is all around us.
Exactly. But the fact of the matter is that the take-home point is these are not forever molecules. If anything comes into the EPA and they see a long persistence scenario, the likelihood of that thing ever making it to market is very, very small. We are not going to have another DDT scenario, and the molecules are just persisting shorter and shorter and shorter. Now, as I said earlier, this is exactly why herbicides are not a silver bullet for plant control, because they are breaking down in the environment so quickly, a lot of times we only get temporary control from a herbicide application.
So the goal is that they're present enough on or in the plants to provide control, but then break down into these harmless molecules in the environment that then nature sort of digests
Yes.
in different ways.
And the word harmless is important because, again, EPA, they need to know and they require to know what is that parent molecule. All right, after it breaks down into two things, what are those? Are they toxic? Because if they are, we have a real problem. Third, what do those break down into? Are they toxic? If we are increasing toxicity by this breakdown process, problem, the product is never coming to market. We have to know and ensure and prove that that active herbicide molecule is breaking down into things that are harmless in the environment.
Because like we said, when a molecule breaks down, it doesn't break down into smaller pieces of itself. It breaks down into newer things.
Exactly.
Okay. So to review, I think the goal of this episode was to provide an overview of herbicides, right? So some things that stand out to me. There is significant progress that has been made with the technology of herbicides. What we used hundreds of years ago because we didn't quite know any better is a lot different than what we do and use now because we've progressed with the research and the registration process is another part of it. Thanks to people like Rachel Carson, there has been this push and initiative and attention towards the quality of these things that we use in the environment that we take very seriously today. And then finally, these herbicides, after they are designed and created, there is a way that they break down and change in the environment after they do their job that we can appreciate. And those that you reviewed were microbial, sunlight, photolysis, and then, of course, water or the things surrounding that herbicide in the environment through hydrolysis. What are your big takeaways from this episode?
Well, we started the episode saying that using herbicides or any type of pesticide is a philosophical position. And I wanted to kind of give where my head is and how I view these things philosophically. And I wanted to leave everyone with sort of an example of how I think about herbicides. And the best example I've come up with is comparing them to medicine. All right, I want to compare a herbicide to medicine. So stick with me for a minute as we kind of unpack this a little bit. So think about taking blood pressure medicine. Usually the doctor will prescribe that and say, you need to take this with diet and exercise. So there's an integrated approach. It's not just relying on the chemical, it's relying on other things. And herbicides are no different. Herbicides should be coupled with harvesting, with prevention, with biocontrol. All right, we should never just rely on herbicides, just like you shouldn't simply rely on a pill. Another thing, these medicines are very specific, okay? It's not the same pill that you take for a headache that you also take for heart disease, right? There are specific medicines for specific ailments. With herbicides, there are specific molecules, specific products that you use for specific weeds. We have one that we'll use for water hyacinth. We'll have another that we'll use for torpedo grass, okay? And just like a skilled medical professional prescribes you what you need to help solve your problems, lake managers pair and partner these herbicides with other techniques to address the needs of that lake at that time with those weeds and those issues. So all of this has to be put together in a prescriptive plan. So whenever a manager writes a management option for a lake, you can think of it just like a prescription from a physician. And the other thing, too, when you start thinking about medicine for your body, we don't want to wait until we have huge issues before we address the problem. If you have a chronic issue like lung disease or heart disease, they rarely get better on their own. And the longer you wait, the further you progress with the disease, the more impact that it has on your body. So starting early with all the types of preventions that you can is always best. You need to think of invasive plants in our native ecosystems just like a chronic problem. We have them forever, all right? They're not going away, and they're not going to get better on their own. They don't have natural enemies here that are going to manage them. That's why we have to step in. It is the problem we brought in. It's the problem we have to help address. So waiting until that plant problem has reached cataclysmic populations is not what's best for the environment. Going in early, being preventative, being proactive, not just relying on our medicine, on our herbicide to solve the problem, but being proactive, being an active manager keeps that system healthy, and it allows us to use a very little bit of medicine or herbicide instead of having to come in and solve a big problem all at once.
Yeah, I always appreciated that metaphor when you first said it to me, these sort of plant management treatments. So thank you so much for listening to this episode as we provided an overview of herbicides used in aquatic plant management. Our goal for the next episode is to start talking about how these herbicides work. There's a lot of different ways that they operate, but we're going to try to explain two or four different ways that they operate. And so if you have any more questions about this topic, please send them in and email us at caip@ifas.ufl.edu. That's cape@ifas.ufl.edu. And we hope you continue listening as we turn science into solutions.